It's time to read the Des Moines Register for today, Tuesday, February 27th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Pat Steele. My partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Deanna Snyder. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinion, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes to the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Today we're looking for mild conditions, some sunshine, windy in the afternoon. We're looking at a high of 63. Tonight, then, the mercury plunges down to 10 degrees. Winds will be out of the northeast, 10 to 20 miles an hour. And there's a possibility of a little snow tonight, so we're going to be on a roller coaster here weather-wise. Tomorrow, much colder, high of 34, low of 25. But we bounce back up on Thursday and Friday. Thursday in the 50s, Friday in the 60s. Our normal high for this time of year is 40 degrees. Our normal low is 22. A record high set back in 04, I believe, 77 degrees and minus 14 in 1963. Sunrise this morning at 6:53 and sunset tonight at 6:02. From the front page or main section of Des Moines Register, the headlines are these: two Des Moines Public Service Libraries to lose staff next year, and Pettit, a developer accused of fraud, asked to be released early from the Polk County Jail. From the Metro and Iowa section, a woman hurt in drag racing crash is suing. Gray wolf was found dead near Davenport. And Central Campus is a marine biology expert, and here's why the United Nations picked him for a research project. So those are our headlines and the weather. And now here is Deanna with our first story.
Thank you, Pat. All right, two public school libraries are to lose staff next year. The budget shortfall forces some hard decisions. This is from Samantha Hernandez of the Des Moines Register. For the last 3 years, library associate Emily Smith has worked in the McCombs Middle School Library, helping students connect with literature and maintaining the book collection. Before she was hired for the position, Smith had never considered working as a librarian, despite being an avid reader. She said, "It was really something that I completely fell in love with. I have such a passion for getting books to kids, and literacy is so important." Earlier this month, Smith was among the three library associates and two tech media teachers who learned they had been classified as excess employees. Though the employees will not be laid off, they will likely be assigned to new positions for the 24-25 school year. The reassignment of Smith and Hoyt Middle School's library associate will bring to 12 the number of the district's 57 libraries that no longer have a dedicated staff member. Currently, the district has two certified librarians, 30 library associates, and 16 technology, tech media educators. The positions open at each school are decided by Des Moines School's personnel department, said Phil Rader, Des Moines School's spokesperson. Then it is up to the principals to determine the positions their school requires based upon that allocation and their needs for the next school year's enrollment. Excuse me. Principals are facing a choice between teachers and librarians. Principals at McCombs and Hoyt made the decision to use the open positions to staff classrooms. Unfortunately, given our current budget for the next year, we have had to make some tough decisions on staffing for the upcoming school year, said McCombs principal Jason Snow. At McCombs, we chose to prioritize providing high-quality classroom instruction for all of our students and to support our district's school board goals, meaning we had to make some cuts to other positions. Smith knows that Snow had a difficult choice to make when deciding which positions to cut. She said, "Honestly, I'm just mad in general that my principal had to make a decision like that, and mad that libraries are not more valued in our public schools." Hoyt and McCombs officials are looking into how they can ensure students can use the library when needed. Students at Hoyt will continue to have access to library resources even in the absence of assigned library staff, said Principal Faru Bishara Rantisi. We will implement various strategies, including self-checkout options, assistance from staff or volunteers, and classroom libraries. However, we are still refining these plans for Hoyt to ensure they align with the specific needs of the school community and district guidelines. Two Des Moines school libraries already have systems in place that allow students to check out books on their own. Rader said those libraries do have staff who are partially assigned to work there. Lincoln High School is the only school without a dedicated library space, said Rader. This is due to the student enrollment and facility needs, he said. The library was remodeled and now houses classroom spaces. In the case of Lincoln, but also in any school to one degree or another, students have access to resources in a variety of different ways, from online material to in-classroom library spaces. While unrelated, the staffing changes come at a time when district officials are trying to cut at least $14 million ahead of the 24-25 school year. At least $3 million of those cuts are expected to come from staff positions. Rader said, however, this does reflect the pressure of public schools being underfunded for several years, resulting in difficult staffing decisions and changes to try to make the best use of limited resources. As for Smith, she is resigned to the fact that her job will change next year, but hopes school officials will find a way to make the libraries available to students. Not all of our students can access public libraries, Smith said, so there's really only the one place that they can go to get books. It literally helps our students do better in classes, whether they're reading fantasy or nonfiction. Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Deanna. The other front page story is Pettit, a developer accused of fraud, asked to be released. This is a story by Reader's Watchdog writer Lee Rude. In a letter penned this month to the judge who jailed him, Johnston developer Daniel Pettit, drowning in debt and besieged by accusations of fraud, apologized for his lack of respect for the judicial process, asked to be released early, and promising to do right by investors he is accused of cheating. The 43-year-old developer said in the February 13th letter to Judge Jeannie Vaught, "My behavior was out of character, and I truly want to fix the situation." Pettit, who disappeared for a month after failing to turn himself in to serve his six-month sentence for contempt in civil court cases, has been behind bars since he was arrested January 12th. In his letter to Vaught, he asked for 2 days of credit off his six-month sentence for each of the 10 days he'd labored in a worker's pod at the Polk County Jail, even though it is typically not given for contempt. The one-time Waukee mayoral candidate also asked for 60 days on electronic monitoring instead of jail so he could do right by his investors. He said that with time and less pressure, he could address a long list of things that the New Jersey lawyer who helped him round up the investors, Stephen Katz, says he needs to do so he and that the investors can begin to be made whole. He wrote, "I should have done this months ago and regret my poor decision of not complying and ending this honorably with Mr. Katz when I could have. It should have never got here and is 100% per my actions." Vaught, who jailed Pettit after she said he'd not been forthcoming in three civil cases, secretly transferred assets and harmed investors and companies, big, medium, and small, has taken no action regarding the letter. In the 2.5 months since Watchdog first reported on the roughly $70 million in debt and judgments against the fallen businessman and the local, state, and federal investigations into his activities, Pettit's legal difficulties have intensified. While he claimed back in September to have cash assets of $2 million and total assets of $56 million, some of those assets are mired in legal tug-of-wars among investors, banks, and former business associates trying to recoup what they can. Pettit transferred the deed to his Johnston mansion with a 9-hole golf course and heated pool to one of the people angered by his alleged deception. He signed the quit claim deed over to Brett Jacobson of Austin, Texas, who last spring in a civil lawsuit alleged breach of contract and fraud. The lawsuit came after Pettit bought the rights to purchase from Jacobson a rare Bugatti Chiron Super Sport, but never carried through with the deal for the French hypercar. The $5.5 million 26-acre estate at 7395 100th Street, one of the most expensive in Iowa, has been listed for sale for the last month, but the home has liens against it, including one filed by the Iowa Department of Revenue for almost $36,000 in overdue income taxes. Previously successful in carrying out some major development deals in the Des Moines Metro, Pettit appears to have begun encountering big financial troubles when the COVID-19 pandemic hit. By 2021, partners who'd loaned him money for development projects in West Des Moines and Waukee began accusing him of fraud, court documents show. Banks foreclosed on properties he said he was going to develop. Contractors from consulting to construction filed mechanics liens on his property. Investors from Illinois, Minnesota, New Jersey, Nevada, New York, and Utah obtained court judgments worth millions. In another twist in Pettit's case, a man who ran a luxury car rental business in Los Angeles and who did business with Pettit but later was accused of robbing him at his Johnston mansion last September was arrested this month in connection with a major drug ring in California, federal court documents show. Mustafas Mustafas, age 43, who faces charges of burglary, robbery, and theft in the Johnston heist, fled Iowa after being extradited to the state in the Pettit case, only to be arrested again in Malibu by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. He faces charges of possession with intent to deliver for his alleged involvement in the meth cocaine ring, federal court records show. Mustafas, who is scheduled to be arraigned in Polk County on April 3rd, Mustafas' former lawyer, Nick Sarconi, previously told Watchdog the California man was an aficionado of Rolex watches, and that's initially how he and Pettit met. He said Mustafa came to Iowa in summer 2023 to work on a development deal in Johnston. Johnston police documents suggested the heist Pettit alleged in September may have been staged, as Pettit reportedly communicated with Mustafa both before and after the reported robbery. Two businessmen who were at Pettit's home at the time of the robbery later learned through police reports that Pettit had texted Mustafa prior, saying the two, former Pettit business partners Matt Jennings and Dr. Ellen Stoy, were thieves. Mustafa, a Johnston police report says, responded with rough talk about both men texting Pettit that he was going to take back what they stole and, quote, forgive them for not knowing who you were in bed with a smiley face. I will be there with a bunch of good fellows, end of quote. Pettit also talked to Mustafa by phone four times right after the alleged heist, once for about an hour, the police report says. Jessica Grove, an assistant city attorney in West Des Moines, said the city is still pursuing insurance payments from a surety bond posted by Pettit to develop infrastructure at the Sugar Creek residential development near Des Moines University, while the insurance company has sued Pettit in federal court. None of the infrastructure for the development there has been completed. In the meantime, Ryan Wiederstein, broker and owner at WB Real Estate in Clive, became the latest to sue Pettit this month, filing the litigation in civil court in Dallas County. Wiederstein could not be reached Thursday or Friday for comment. The lawsuit names Pettit individually and his companies, Encompass Holdings and South Branch Investment LLC, and alleges breach of purchase agreement, tortious interference with contract and business expectancy, and fraud in connection with the attempted sale of South Branch Business Park in West Des Moines in 2021. On October 27, 2023, Judge Jeffrey Farrell entered a $3.4 million judgment against Pettit and his companies in favor of SBBP JV 21, a limited liability corporation run by Wiederstein. Wiederstein alleges in the civil lawsuit, which is separate from the monetary judgment in favor of SBBP JV 21, that Encompass never executed a promised development agreement with the city, leaving his development partnership in the lurch. He said Pettit and Encompass paid $15,000 in earnest money to buy back the South Branch property in December 2021, but never closed on the deal after several revised and delayed contracts were signed. By this time, prices had increased and the city required SBBP JV 21 to renegotiate the terms of development, resulting in large increase in development and carrying costs, the lawsuit says. The lawsuit also alleges Pettit personally should be held responsible for damages because he abused his corporate privilege and operated as a mere sham, as buyer was not appropriately capitalized or insured, and funds were commingled between buyer entities and Mr. Pettit. The lawsuit seeks compensatory and punitive damages plus interest at the highest rate available under the law. Deanna.
Thank you, Pat. Okay, a couple of brief articles in the front of the Metro in Iowa section. Woman hurt in drag racing crash is suing. Targets the driver, says insurers wrongly denied the claim. This is from William Morris, the Des Moines Register. A driver badly injured in the 2022 car crash that killed her nephew is now suing her auto insurer and one of the other drivers in the crash, who has since been convicted of drag racing. Mayra DeCatalan was driving on Fleur Drive on December 13th of 2022 when she was struck by a car driven at high speeds by Robert Miller, totaling both vehicles. DeCatalan, who had her young son and nephew in the vehicle with her, was badly injured in the crash, and her nephew, 4-year-old Marcus Vaguada, was killed. Miller and another motorist, Keith Jones, have both been criminally convicted of drag racing and other offenses for their driving conduct leading up to the crash. Now, DeCatalan and her husband are suing Jones for negligence, conspiracy, and aiding and abetting. The lawsuit alleges that Jones encouraged Miller's reckless driving, directly contributing to the ensuing crash. According to the lawsuit, Miller, who is not named as a defendant, was insured by American Family, which has paid out to the limit of his liability coverage. But Jones's insurance carrier, Allstate, has denied full liability based on a drag racing exclusion in his policy. The DeCatalans are insured through State Farm and paid for additional stacking coverage for damages caused by uninsured and underinsured motorists that they say they are owed. State Farm, they say, has instead refused to pay any amount under their uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage and has refused to provide any explanation why. The lawsuit, filed February 13th, seeks judgment against State Farm for the damages sustained by the DeCatalans, as well as damages against Jones. They are not seeking damages on behalf of Marcos Vaguada's estate, which is not a party to the lawsuit. Jones, who is currently in custody and awaiting trial in an unrelated case in State Farm, do not yet have attorneys listed to represent them. An attorney for the DeCatalans declined to comment. And then a gray wolf is found dead near Davenport. The animal was discovered in the median along I-80. This is from Susan Stapleton of Des Moines Register. Officials from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources discovered a young adult male gray wolf lying in the median of I-80 in Scott County last Monday morning. State Conservation Officer Brooks Vanderbeek discovered the animal, estimated to be 2 years old, near the I-280 interchange. The Iowa State University Veterinary Diagnostic Lab in Ames inspected the animal to confirm cause of death, and the Department of Natural Resources sent tissue samples to determine the wolf's population of origin and whether it was a true wolf or a hybrid. The Great Lakes wolf population in Minnesota and Wisconsin lives closest to Iowa, although the state has only seen 1 to 5 wolves pass through over the last 5 years, the state agency said in a news release. Iowa does not have a breeding population of wolves, the department said. While it is rare for wolves to be in Iowa, this serves as a reminder to coyote hunters to be very sure of your target before pulling the trigger, state fur bearer biologist Vince Evelsizer said in a news release. State wildlife veterinarian Dr. Rachel Rudin said the wolf did have tapeworms, including echinococcus, which can infect people. This serves as a good reminder for our hunters, trappers, and wildlife rehabilitators to take care when handling coyotes and foxes, she said in a news release. Evelsizer noted that a trail camera picked up an image of a gray wolf in Delaware County, west of Dubuque, that showed a wolf with similar coloring in November. Evelsizer said, "We don't know for sure if it's the same animal or not. We're thankful that Officer Vanderbeek spotted this animal and picked it up." The Great Lakes wolf population has been steady to slightly increasing in recent years, the department said. This wolf weighed 77.5 pounds and measured 62 inches from nose to the tip of the tail, the agency said. Note that wolves are protected in Iowa, and there is no open season. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. That's where in the Metro and Iowa section, we have a couple of pictures of some bicyclists, and they were bundled up on Saturday for the 10th annual Frozen Ride. It's a free event that accepted donations to maintain and improve the Clive Greenbelt Trail. It may not have been all too frozen. Clive recorded a high of 52 degrees on Saturday, but cyclists donned their jackets to visit various stops along the 15-mile route, including the Front Row in Clive and Norm's Pub, the Key, and Kenny's Garage in Waukee. Central Campus has a marine biology expert, and here's why the United Nations picked him for the research project. This is a story written by Victoria Rena Rodriguez of the Register. More than 1,000 miles away from the nearest ocean, a Des Moines public school teacher from Central Campus is assisting the United Nations in international efforts to review the state of the world's oceans. Dr. Greg J. Berard was chosen to participate in this effort as part of a pool of experts for its regular process for global reporting and assessment of the state of the marine environment, according to the DMPS blog. Started in 2002, the initiative reviews the environmental, economic, and social aspects of the world's oceans. Berard will be working with the Cephalod team, as his research focus and expertise focuses on nautiluses, octopuses, squid, and cuttlefish, the Des Moines Public School blog reported. His work will provide another perspective to discuss local issues in the Des Moines area within a broader context of their connections to the world, Berard said. He added, "Science can inform socioeconomic solutions and vice versa, both at the world level but also at our local level." He also expects some of the scientists he's working with will be able to guest lecture in his classes for Des Moines students. Berard's new work with the United Nations is in addition to several affiliations he has, according to the Des Moines Public School System blog. He is a research scientist with the American Museum of Natural History, a conservation biologist with Save the Nautilus, a member of the International Union for Conservation of Nature Species Survival Commission Mollusk Specialist Group, and also works with the United States Endangered Species Act and the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. That's all very impressive. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. All right, large fight breaks out at middle school cafeteria. This is from Celia Broker of the Ames Tribune. Ames police were dispatched to Ames Middle School shortly after 8:45 Monday morning to assist with a large fight. Juveniles were fighting each other and adults in the school's cafeteria, according to a press release from the Ames Police Department. The police restrained one student who was acting violently after officers arrived and separated the individuals involved, the press release said. A school-wide hold was implemented after the fight so that the matter could be addressed appropriately, said Ames Middle School Principal Boston Freilinger. According to the Ames Community School District's website, a hold is issued when a non-imminent threat is occurring within the building. It may be issued when there is a need to isolate movement in a specific portion of the building. Students are expected to clear hallways and remain in a room or area until the all-clear is given. Monday's hold was lifted at 9:25 in the morning, and Ames police left the scene around 9:57 a.m. Amber Christian said officers did not know how many individuals were involved in the fight and were unaware of anyone needing medical attention. Freilinger assured parents that all necessary measures were taken to ensure the safety of the students and staff. Freilinger said, "I want every school community member to understand the gravity of this situation. Engaging in fights not only endangers the physical well-being of those involved, but also undermines the respectful and conducive learning environment we strive to maintain," It tarnishes our school's reputation and disrespects the hard work of those dedicated to providing a positive educational experience. Freilinger said the middle school took the necessary steps to ensure school could continue as usual on Monday and asked parents to open a dialogue with their students about violence. The email said, "We encourage you to have an open dialogue with your students about the importance of resolving conflicts peacefully and seeking help from a trusted adult when needed. Please reassure them that their safety is our top priority." The Ames Police Department issued juvenile referrals for disorderly conduct and interference with official acts. Additional charges are pending, the department said. The Ames High School Board voted unanimously to end its school resource officer program 2 years ago. A joint recommendation from then-interim Superintendent Paula Vincent and Ames City Manager Steve Shanker sparked that decision. The Ames Tribune reported in December that the Ames Police Department had responded to more than 700 calls at Ames schools since the board chose to remove resource officers in December of 2021. Of those calls, 392 were to the high school, 317 to the middle school. A string of October fights at the Ames High School plagued the start of the school in 2023-24 academic year. High school principal Dr. Paul Neubendahl sent out a similarly worded email to parents on October 18th after police were called to investigate a fight that involved juveniles the day before. The Ames Police Department filed an incident report for a fight at the high school on October 17th, and videos of the alleged scuffle circulated on social media. Neubendahl told parents that several fights in the days prior seriously disrupted our learning environment and threatened the safety of our students and staff. "This kind of behavior is intolerable. I cannot express strongly enough how deeply disturbed I am by these actions." Neubendahl's email continued to discourage student violence after sharing the same message that was sent to middle school parents Monday morning. It said, "I want every school community member to understand this situation's gravity. Engaging in fights not only endangers the physical well-being of those involved, but also undermines the respectful and conducive learning environment that we strive to maintain. It tarnishes our school's reputation and disrespects the hard work of those dedicated to providing a positive educational experience." Ames Community School District Superintendent Dr. Julius Lawson stressed his desire to curb student violence at a school board meeting a few days later on October 23rd. Lawson said recent high school fights weren't exclusive to any race, program group, gender, age, or grade level after he took a deep dive into the data to find a cause for the fights. He said, "We are still actively working with school leaders to mitigate fights and all other acts of violence within our district. Fear has no place in our schools. The emotional and physical safety of our students and staff are paramount." Two closed special sessions were held within a week of the October 23rd board meeting to discipline several Ames High School students. Two students were expelled from the high school, and consent expulsion agreements were approved for three students. The board would not confirm if the agreements meant the students were expelled from school or not, nor would they confirm whether the expulsions were related to school violence. Former Ames Middle School teacher and current substitute Missy Springsteen-Hout said that Ames School Board asked the Ames School Board for additional staffing at a November 20th school board meeting, suggesting the faculty was overwhelmed. The teacher did not reference any specific incident, but was worried about how the teacher shortage could worsen if the district didn't address it soon. She asked the board to consider adding an associate principal at the middle school. "It's very clear if you spend even 5 minutes in the middle school that people are drowning," Springsteen-Hout said at the November board meeting, adding, "We need another assistant principal back." Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. A couple weather-related stories from the Metro section. Des Moines hit 78 degrees, breaking a 128-year-old heat record. It hasn't been this hot in more than a century. Temperatures in Des Moines broke records Monday, with temperatures at the Des Moines International Airport hitting 78 degrees as of 3:30 p.m. That exceeded even the forecasted high of 75. The previous record high for February 26 was 70 degrees in 1896. It also ties the record for an all-time high in February, which was set in 1930. Waterloo, Mason City, and Ottumwa also hit new daily records. The average high temperature for February 26th is usually around 40 degrees, according to the National Weather Service. The Des Moines area nearly doubled that on Monday. National Weather Service in Des Moines posted on social media about extreme fire conditions as well. Most of Iowa is under a red flag warning for high temperatures and dry conditions. The Weather Service warned people not to burn anything within the state as fire will spread quickly. Winds on Monday were expected from the southeast at 10 to 16 miles per hour in the afternoon. Gusts could get as high as 31 miles per hour. The low Monday night was expected to be 42 degrees. Winds were expected to calm into the evening with a mostly clear sky. Colder air will move in Tuesday with a forecast high of 62 and an overnight low of 14. The high Wednesday is expected to be 33 degrees. Wind chills early Wednesday morning could be below zero in most of central and northern Iowa. And another related story, spring weather predictions from the Farmer's Almanac. Will the burr linger a while? This is a story by Victoria Reina Rodriguez of the Register. The Farmer's Almanac has released annual weather predictions for more than 200 years. These predictions are based on a formula comparing data found in solar patterns and historical weather conditions with current solar activity. Let's see how accurate its predictions have been this winter and what's in store for the spring. What was the Farmer Almanac's winter forecast for Iowa and how did it hold up? The annual outlook released last August called for a frigid winter with cold temperatures and lots of snow, claiming that the burr is back. That's B-R-R-R. The Farmer's Almanac predicted plenty of cold temperatures and occasional bouts of storminess, bringing widespread rains and snows to the Great Plains. To date this season, Des Moines' winter snowfall total was at 31.4 inches as measured by the National Weather Service. Last winter, a total of 33.1 inches of snow fell in Des Moines, with the snowiest month of the season being March, accounting for 10.3 inches. Considering Des Moines saw 27.2 inches of snow this January alone, it's safe to say this has, in fact, been a snowy season. The average yearly snowfall for Des Moines is about 35 inches, according to the National Weather Service. Des Moines saw 24.98 inches of rain in 2023 and 10.86 inches of rain since the 2023-2024 Farmer's Almanac was released in August. According to the National Weather Service, the yearly precipitation average in Des Moines is around 36 inches. Pending the arrival of more rain and snow this season, it seemed for the most part that the almanac's winter outlook has proven to be accurate. What does the spring weather forecast predict in Iowa? The Northern Hemisphere will welcome spring during the spring equinox on Tuesday, March 19th, but the almanac says the season and weather may not be on the same page. The burr might stay a while. Near Easter, the almanac expects heavy Midwest storms to sweep east to northeast, producing a northern snow with heavy showers and thunderstorms to the south. North central states can also plan for many days of cold temperatures this spring with possible late snow through much of April, according to the almanac. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. Two men are killed in apparent murder-suicide and are identified. This is from Jose Mandiola of the Des Moines Register. The two men who were found dead in a parking lot north of Des Moines on February 23rd have been identified. The Polk County Sheriff's Office was dispatched to 5153 Northeast 17th Street at 6:43 a.m. Friday regarding a person who had been shot, said Captain Ryan Evans, a spokesperson. The men were found dead at the scene in a parking lot in front of Power Brace Manufacturing, a steel fabrication company, just across from the Polk County Jail, Evans said. Witness statements, evidence located at the scene, and video evidence are leading investigators to believe it was a murder-suicide case, Evans said. Investigators believe one man shot the other and then shot himself. The victim has been identified as Francisco Leonel Rivera Cosme, age 33, of Des Moines. He worked for the company where he was shot, Evans said. The suspect in the apparent murder-suicide has been identified as Alexis Manuel Lopez Rivera, age 31, of West Des Moines. Investigators believe that the victim and the suspect knew each other before the shooting. Investigators are still working to determine the motive. The company where Cosme worked did not immediately respond to requests for comment. And then a short article from page 2 of the main section. Former Ankeny School Board President Ryan Weldon is running for the Iowa House. He says he brings fresh perspective and prosperity to District 41. This is from Stephen Gruber Miller. Former Ankeny High School Board President Ryan Weldon is running for an Ankeny-based Iowa House seat, seeking to challenge Democratic incumbent Representative Molly Buck. Weldon, a Republican, filed paperwork Monday declaring his candidacy for Iowa House District 41, which includes the north half of Ankeny. He said, "My goal is to bring a fresh and innovative perspective, working towards a stronger, more prosperous future for all residents of District 41. Weldon was elected to the Ankeny School Board in 2019 and served as the board's vice president and president during his 4 years in office. He lost his re-election race in 2023 as a slate of candidates backed by progressive groups flipped control of the board. While serving on the school board, Weldon voted to end the district's mask mandate and against the creation of a new district job focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion. In a news release announcing his candidacy for the Iowa House, Weldon touted his, quote, dedication to championing educational opportunity, fostering economic growth, and ensuring fiscal responsibility. He said, I believe in individual freedom, fiscal responsibility, state sovereignty, capitalism, and the free market, human dignity, limited government, and a strong education system that allows parents and students to have a choice in their educational journey. Weldon and his wife, Regina, live in Ankeny. They have 4 children. He will appear on the ballot in the June 4th Republican primary. Buck was elected to the House in 2022, flipping what had been a Republican-held seat. Pat.
Okay, we'll now turn to national and world news from the Des Moines Register. And our first article in this section is dueling border visits for Biden and Trump on Thursday. Joey Garrison of the USA Today wrote this article, which is Dateline Washington, D.C. President Joe Biden plans to make a rare visit to the southern border Thursday to call Republicans out for blocking border legislation. It's the same day his rival, former President Donald Trump, is planning his own border stops. Biden will visit Brownsville, Texas, a White House official said, to meet with the Border Patrol agents, law enforcement officials, and local leaders. Trump, the frontrunner to win the Republican nomination, had already scheduled a Thursday visit to Eagle Pass, Texas, about 325 miles away. Corinne Jean-Pierre said, when asked about the Trump's dueling visit, I don't have a reaction to the former president, not going to speak to his schedule. Biden's trip to the southern border, the second of his presidency, is part of an attempt to flip the script as record migration remains one of his biggest election liabilities. In a major shift, Biden has embraced tougher rhetoric on the border and blamed congressional Republicans for inaction after they killed legislation this month, at Trump's urging, that would have created some of the most aggressive border restrictions in years. Biden said, every day between now and November, the American people are going to know that the only reason the border is not secure is Donald Trump and his MAGA Republican friends. Republicans are overwhelmingly viewed more favorably on the border. An NBC poll this month found voters view Trump as a better candidate than Biden to secure the border and control immigration by 57% to 22%. Carolyn Leavitt, the Trump campaign's national press secretary, slammed Biden's visit in a statement, saying his last-minute, insincere attempt to chase President Trump to the border won't cut it. Americans know Biden is single-handedly responsible for the worst immigration crisis in history, Leavitt said. During Biden's visit Thursday, the president will discuss the urgent need to pass the border security legislation, Jean-Pierre said. He will reiterate His call is for congressional Republicans to stop playing politics and to provide the funding needed for additional U.S. Border Patrol agents, more asylum officers, fentanyl detection technology, and more. The bipartisan border legislation would have given the Biden administration the power to shut down the border to migrants under certain circumstances. With the bill stalled, Biden is considering executive action on the border under federal immigration powers once used by Trump to achieve some of the policies in the legislation, risking a backlash from progressives and immigration advocates. Jean-Pierre declined to say whether Biden will be announcing any new policies during the trip, but said no executive action can duplicate the bipartisan border bill. Deanna?
Okay, another article on Trump. Trump appeals $454 million ruling in fraud case. Lawyers asking if New York judge abused discretion or acted in excess. This is from Michael Cisak of Associated Press. Dateline New York. Donald Trump has appealed his $454 million New York civil fraud judgment, challenging a judge's finding that the former president lied about his wealth as he grew the real estate empire that launched him to stardom and the presidency. Trump's lawyers filed notices of appeal Monday, asking the state's mid-level appeals court to overturn Judge Arthur Engoron's February 16th verdict in Attorney General Letitia James' lawsuit and reversing the staggering penalties that threatened to wipe out Trump's cash reserves. Trump's lawyers wrote in court papers that they are asking the appeals court to decide whether Engoron committed errors of law and or fact, and whether he abused his discretion or acted in excess of his jurisdiction. Trump's appeal paperwork did not address whether Trump was seeking to pause collection of the judgment while he appeals by putting up money, assets, or an appeal bond covering the amount owed to qualify for an automatic stay. Messages seeking comment were left with Trump's lawyers and the New York Attorney General's office. Engoron found that Trump, his company, and top executives, including his sons Eric and Donald Jr., schemed for years to deceive banks and insurers by inflating his wealth on financial statements issued to secure loans and make deals. Among other penalties, the judge put strict limitations on the ability of Trump's company, the Trump Organization, to do business. The appeal ensures that the legal fight over Trump's business practices will persist into the thick of the presidential primary season and likely beyond, as he tries to clinch the Republican presidential nomination in his quest to retake the White House. If upheld, Engoron's ruling will force Trump to give up a sizable chunk of his fortune. Engoron ordered Trump to pay $355 million in penalties, but with interest, the total has grown to nearly $454 million. That total will increase by nearly $112,000 per day until he pays. Trump maintains that he is worth several billion dollars and testified last year that he had about $400 million in cash in addition to properties and other investments. James, a Democrat, told ABC News that if Trump is unable to pay, she will seek to seize some of his assets. Trump's appeal was expected. Trump had vowed to appeal, and his lawyers had been laying the groundwork for months by objecting frequently to Engoron's handling of the trial. Trump said Engoron's decision, the costliest consequence of his recent legal troubles, was election interference and weaponization against a political opponent. Trump complained he was being punished for having built a perfect company, great cash, great buildings, great everything. Trump's lawyer, Christopher Keis, said after the verdict that the former president was confident the appeals court will ultimately correct the innumerable and catastrophic errors made by a trial court untethered to the law or to reality. Trump lawyer Alina Haba said, "Given the grave stakes, we trust that the appellate division will overturn this egregious verdict and end this relentless persecution against my clients." If the decision stands, Haba said, it will serve as a signal to every single American that New York is no longer open for business. Trump wasn't able to appeal the decision immediately because the clerk's office at Engoron's courthouse had to file paperwork known as a judgment to make it official. That was done Friday, starting a 30-day window for Trump to pay up or file an appeal and seek a stay. During the trial, Trump's lawyers accused Engoron of tangible and overwhelming bias. They've also objected to the legal mechanics of James' lawsuit. Trump contends the law she sued him under is a consumer protection statute that's normally issued or used to rein in businesses that rip off customers. Trump's lawyers have already gone to the appellate division at least 10 times to challenge Engoron's prior rulings, including during the trial in an unsuccessful bid to reverse a gag order and $15,000 in fines for violations after Trump made a disparaging and false social media post about a key court staffer. Trump's lawyers have long argued that some of the allegations are barred by the statute of limitations, contending that Engoron failed to comply with an appellate division ruling last year, that he narrowed the scope of the trial to weed out outdated allegations. If Trump is unsuccessful at the appellate division, he can ask the state's highest court, the Court of Appeals, to consider taking his case. The appeal is one of Trump's many legal challenges. He has been indicted on criminal charges 4 times in the last year. He is accused in Georgia and Washington, D.C., of plotting to overturn his 2020 election loss to Democrat Joe Biden. In Florida, he is charged with hoarding classified documents. He is scheduled to go on trial next month in Manhattan for falsifying business records related to hush money paid to adult film actor Stormy Daniels on his behalf. In January, a jury ordered Trump to pay $83.3 million to writer E. Jean Carroll for defaming her after she accused him in 2019 of sexually assaulting her in a Manhattan department store in the 1990s. That's on top of the $5 million a jury awarded Carroll in a related trial last year. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. McDaniel announced his resignation as RNC chair. This is a story written by David Jackson of USA Today and Dateline Washington. Ronna McDaniel formally announced her resignation Monday as chair of the Republican National Committee, clearing the way for former President Donald Trump and allies to more firmly take control of the party and its finances. McDaniel said in a statement, "The RNC, Republican National Committee, has historically undergone change once we have a nominee, and has always been my intention to honor that tradition." Her announcement as much as declared Trump the presumptive nominee after his win Saturday in the South Carolina primary. McDaniel said she will make her resignation official March 8th in Houston when the committee is expected to name Trump-chosen replacements. Trump has nominated Michael Whatley, the chair of the North Carolina State Republican Party, to replace McDaniel, and chose his daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, as co-chair. Laura Trump has already become the public face of Trump's revamped RNC. The former president, who faces the prospect of 4 criminal trials this campaign year, has had more than $500 million in civil judgments levied against him over the past month. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, who continues to oppose Trump in Republican presidential primaries, said he wants to take over the RNC in order to exercise control of its money and pay his massive legal bills. Haley told CNN earlier this month, "I don't want the RNC to become his piggy bank for his personal court cases. Now we see him trying to get control of the RNC so he can continue not to have to pay his own legal fees." Chris LaCivita, a Trump campaign senior advisor who is also joining the newly revamped RNC, said it will not help Trump with legal bills that include lawyers' fees and massive civil judgments against him. McDaniel defended her record in a resignation statement, including the Republicans winning control of the House in 2022, creating an election integrity department, and building the committee's first small donor grassroots donor program. She said, "I remain committed to winning back the White House and electing Republicans up and down the ballot in November." She indicated she would make her announcement after South Carolina's primary, which was held Saturday. A man who set himself on fire outside embassy has died. Michael Balsamo of the Associated Press wrote this article. An active duty member of the United States Air Force has died after he set himself ablaze outside the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., while declaring that he will no longer be complicit in genocide. The 25-year-old airman, Aaron Bushnell of San Antonio, Texas, died from his injuries, the Metropolitan Police Department said on Monday. He had walked up to the embassy shortly before 1 p.m. Sunday and began live streaming on the video streaming platform Twitch, a person familiar with the matter told the Associated Press. Law enforcement officials believe the man started a live stream, set his phone down, and then doused himself in accelerant and ignited the flames. The video was later removed from the platform, but law enforcement officials have obtained and reviewed a copy. The person was not authorized to publicly discuss details of the ongoing investigation and spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity. In a statement Monday, the Air Force said the individual involved in yesterday's incident succumbed to his injuries and passed away last night. The Air Force said it would provide additional information a day after military officials complete notifying his next of kin. The incident happened as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is seeking cabinet approval for a military operation in the southern Gaza city of Rafah while a temporary ceasefire deal is being negotiated. Israel's military offensive in Gaza, however, has drawn criticisms including genocide claims against the Palestinians. Israel has adamantly denied the genocide allegations and says it is carrying out operations in accordance with international law in the Israel-Hamas war. In December, a person self-immolated outside the Israeli consulate in Atlanta and used gasoline as an accelerant, according to Atlanta's fire authorities. A Palestinian flag was found at the scene, and the act was believed to be one of, quote, extreme political protests, unquote. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. From page six, electric school buses make headway. Many areas remain slow to adopt technology. This is from Alexa St. John on the Associated Press. The first electric school buses in the United States began running a decade ago in three school districts in California, providing a ride that was much less noisy, smelly, and dirty than the diesel buses that kids and parents were used to. Yet, despite the availability of the technology all these years, fewer than 1% of the 489,000 school buses in the country were electric at the end of 2023. That means nearly all the buses that take many of the nation's children to school still run on a fuel that sends contaminants into the air and is carcinogenic. But that may be changing. The number of electric school buses on the road or on order across the country has more than tripled in the last 2 years. According to the World Resource Institute's Electric School Bus Initiative, that's meant 10 times as many students riding on electrical school buses from around 20,000 in 2020 to 200,000 3 years later. The number of states with electric bus legislation or goals also grew from 2 to 14. Still, parent advocates and organizations come up against a number of challenges in getting electrical school bus buy-in elsewhere. It's just a matter of breaking down those barriers, said Alicia Cox, a mother of two in Jackson, Wyoming. Her state is the only one to not have a single district with an electric bus operating. Cox's son, a second grader, often rides a diesel bus to school. As the executive director of Yellowstone Teton Clean Cities, a nonprofit that focuses on sustainable transportation, she regularly calls on school districts, fleet managers, and other nonprofit organizations to make the switch, so far to no avail. One of the biggest challenges is still the cost. Parents, advocates, and districts all say the same. Even with the fuel and maintenance savings of an electric bus, they cost 2 to 3 times more than diesel. The Environmental Protection Agency is rolling out $5 billion in funds set aside for zero-emissions buses in the Biden administration's bipartisan infrastructure law, passed in 2021. Nearly 440 grants and rebates totaling $1.8 billion have already been dispersed to replace thousands of buses across several hundred school districts in the U.S. Demand for the money has been heartening, said Christine Keister, a director for the Clean School Bus Program at the EPA. In addition to federal money, advocates have successfully pushed to get funds from sources like the Volkswagen emissions settlement allocated to electric buses. For those districts that are not receiving funding, there are some options to lease electric buses from contracting companies that supply the buses and equipment and lease them to districts at an affordable price. Dearborn Public Schools, a Metro Detroit district where 70% of families are lower income, was ready to explore a new technology when it began operating its first electric bus in December of 2022. Bought with $300,000 of federal grant, it's been operational only about 3 of the 12 months since then due to maintenance and a learning curve with charging. That's not discouraging Dearborn from moving forward with adding 18 more, but it's a risk others may be reluctant to take. Other barriers in the transition to electric are that districts sometimes take a long time to approve electric buses. Delivery can be delayed, and electric buses can require beefing up the electrical supply for the chargers. Wyoming turned down funding from the EPA over worries about how far the buses could go and storing them in cold temperatures. Cox said that school and fleet managers say even though diesel is not as clean, it's getting the job done. Even where districts agree to buy electric school buses, many also continue to buy new diesel buses in parallel. And while the Clean School Bus Program requires recipients to replace their oldest buses first, some districts can't guarantee that because they don't own their fleets, but contract for them. Meanwhile, parents, advocates, and organizations say the switch to electric usually happens when there's a champion at schools. But that itself can be a hurdle, said Elizabeth Brandt, the mother of two children attending Montgomery County Public Schools in Maryland. Her children rode the one electric school bus circulating in her area for about a year before its route was changed. Parents dealing with their kids' asthma are less likely to be able to advocate for change, Brandt said. If you're saving your sick time to help your child see a pulmonologist, Brandt said, you just can't necessarily be the one who's always going to be there on a weekday talking with a lawmaker. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. Hungary's parliament okays Sweden's bid to join NATO. Hungary's parliament voted Monday to ratify Sweden's bid to join NATO, ending months of delays and diplomatic wrangling following the Scandinavian country's security policy shift in response to Russia's war in Ukraine. The vote was the last major hurdle to Sweden joining the military alliance. It passed 188-6. Historically, neutral Sweden applied to join NATO in May 2022, the same time as Finland. Finland became NATO's 31st member in April. Sweden's application was held up by objections from Turkey and Hungary. Turkey expressed reservations about Sweden's support for Kurdish separatist groups and restrictions on arms exports to Turkey. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban, a right-wing nationalist who has forged close ties with Russia, had said criticism of Hungary's democracy by Swedish politicians had soured relations between the two countries and led to reluctance among lawmakers in his Fidesz party to support Sweden's NATO bid. Russia has long opposed NATO expansion. President Vladimir Putin has said Russia will respond if NATO begins to establish military infrastructure in either the two nations. Russia has an 830-mile border with Finland. Several people tried to intervene from the outside in the setting of our disputes with Sweden, but this did not help, or rather hampered the issue, Orban said as the vote passed. Hungary is a sovereign country. It does not tolerate being dictated by others, whether it be the content of its decisions or their timing. Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson said his country was now leaving 200 years of neutrality and non-alignment behind us. He told a news conference in Stockholm, NATO membership means that we found a new home within a large number of democracies who have worked together for peace and freedom. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that the Sweden brings with it capable armed forces and a first-class defense industry, and it is spending at least 2% of national gross domestic product on defense, which is NATO's target level.